Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Boy, it's hotter than July here in London right now. Actually, it is July, and we've had incredible temperatures here for seemingly forever. This was a slow burner. It started quite gradually. Temperatures built up, and then we hit 35 degrees, about 90-odd Fahrenheit, 35 Celsius in London, and it's just stayed hot. It's a little cooler today, but as I'm recording this, it's 30 Celsius. I'm reading the temperature readout on my clock here, and it's pretty humid too. So it's the kind of weather that almost impedes you thinking. So hopefully I'm not going to say anything too stupid, but really it's been hot, and they tell us it's going to get even hotter. Plus, we've had to deal with the arrival of the new royal baby, William and Kate. Kate's given birth to George Alexander Louis. And I have to say that whatever you think about the monarchy, whether you're a supporter, whether you're not, they look like a superb family. Just starting out on this adventure of parenthood. And the reason I know so much about it, in fact, I think they should invite me to the christening, is that I was covering this for Canadian, Australian and Irish radio stations over this last week. So if you listen to any of the big stations in Canada, you might have heard me on stations like CFRB 1010 Toronto, or the Nova and Smooth stations down in Australia, or 5AA in Adelaide. Love them to pieces. Great people. They make me want to live in Adelaide. Lovely people there. And Red FM in Cork City in Ireland. I was on all of those stations and more during this week. Giving people impressions of the way this news is being received. And of course, the excitement and drama of it, because we had to wait. We were put on alert on Saturday morning. and then Kate was admitted to hospital first thing, just after dawn on Monday morning. And you know the rest of the story, unless you've lived on a deserted island with access to no media, in which case you probably won't be hearing this. What a week. If you've tried to send an email to the show lately, you might have had a problem. We had for about 7 days, maybe a little less, a glitch with the software that connects my website to an email address. The divert didn't work. Wasn't our fault. It was down to a third party's problems. They've now fixed them, but it does mean that some of your emails may have gone into cyberspace. So if you haven't had a reply and you were expecting one, let me know, because your email may have disappeared. I'm really sorry about that. Never happened before, and I hope that it won't ever happen again. But my webmaster, Adam Cornwell, worked really hard to track down where the problem was, and eventually we nailed it right down. So Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, I salute you, sir. This time round, we're going to do part two of our alien abduction and UFO special. Last time round, of course, we talked to Kathleen Marden in America, the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, the most famous abductees in history. This time round, I'm going to connect with Joanne Summerscales from an organization called AMASH, AMMACH. They support abductees, and there are more of them than you would believe here in this country, the United Kingdom. So we'll cross to Joanne, and maybe one other person too who's got direct experience. So quite exciting. It could be a three-way conversation coming to you very soon. If you want to connect with this show, www.theunexplained.tv. If you'd like to make a donation, it would be very gratefully received right now. You can do that through the website. If you want to send me your paranormal story or experience, I'm still collating those. You can do that through the website. Or you want to suggest a guest or make a comment on the way that I'm doing the show or put me right about something, I'm only too pleased to hear from you. www.theunexplained.tv is the website. Okay, let's cross digitally now to Joanne Summerscales from AMASH, the organization that helps people who've had involvement with aliens. Joanne, thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Howard, for the invitation. It's always nice to share the material that's been going on with AMASH. And I'd really like you to meet someone that I think I've met fairly recently, who's going to come on board with AMASH, one of the new AMASH consultants, come associates, if you don't mind.
I'm absolutely open to anything, and I've already told my listeners that there was a possibility that somebody else was going to join us in this connection. So let's rock and roll.
Well, I'm really delighted. I don't know how much your listeners know about AMASH, but before, if you want me to explain about AMASH, if you haven't already, I'd just like to introduce David Monroe in the Arctic Circle, I believe, David.
Yeah, we're pretty well up here. We're on the same kind of latitude as Moscow, I think.
Whereabouts are you, David? David, nice to meet you here. We haven't had contact before, but nice to meet you like this on this digital hookup. Where are you?
Well, I'm situated in Lossiemouth, which is about 35 miles to the east of Inverness, northeast of Inverness.
Lossiemouth, of course, if my memory serves me correctly, all these years of doing news, is a big RAF base, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. It's approximately a mile from the house here, so... Yeah, we get woken up pretty regularly early in the morning and stuff. But they're welcome inhabitants here. They're fine.
All right. Well, you stay right there. I'm going to talk to Joanne for just a second. I'm going to bring you in. And if you feel that you want to contribute at any point, I think the connection is now good enough to do that. Let's keep all our fingers crossed because we're doing a three-way hookup here. Whereabouts in the UK are you, Joanne?
I'm currently in the East Midlands, Nottinghamshire.
Okay, well, this is great. We're doing a connection right through the UK. We're doing London to Nottinghamshire, all the way up to Lossiemouth in Scotland. That's pretty damn good, and let's hope it holds up. So, Joanne Amash, first of all, I didn't even begin to try to explain what that acronym stands for, so tell me what it is.
Well, I will, and it's an unusual, it's a bit of a mouthful, hence the acronym. It stands for Anomalous Mind Management, and I know that sounds a bit of a mouthful as a concept as well, but it's basically about addressing perception management, mind control, if you like, different kinds of perception management that we're often not even aware of. So I wanted to build that into the base from which I'm building this resource. The rest of it, the A, C, and H is Abductee Contactee Helpline. And we put that together to say, and it's called Amash Project, the Amash Project. And basically, this has been going since 23rd of January 2011. And there is nothing in the UK that really meets what I'm doing and hopefully encouraging many others to come on board with to explore. And this is the abductee contactee phenomena and feeding into all of that. This area really impacts many people, very many more than you could possibly imagine. And the UK, you know, we're used to America having a handle on all of this, and they have some great resources. You've got MUFON, you've got the ICAR people, it's fantastic. You've got a whole lot of stuff, and I've researched a lot of that over the years, but there was just this dearth of resource in the UK. And essentially what Amash does is, first of all, I provide a mobile phone number as a helpline, and I tend to leave that to go to voicemail, simply because when she was only about 15 months old, Amash, so this is last year by a couple of months back, we began to get a lot of interest from media, and The Sun did a little article, the UK Sun newspaper did a little article with a picture of E.T. saying, you know, E.T., phone us at home here.
And I actually saw that article. I saw the online version, and they gave your contact details there, didn't they?
Yeah. So I had a lot of hoax calls. Okay. But I have to tell you, up until that point, I had not, and I really truly believe I had not. So rather than waste my time, I leave it to go to voicemail. I pick up the voicemail and deal with the calls accordingly.
All right. So you filter them at that point. How do you know that at some point look, I get emails, and some of them I think, are they for real? And it may just be the way that people express themselves. How can you be absolutely certain that you wouldn't dismiss somebody who'd had a genuine experience, perhaps, or they felt they had, but sounded to you to be a bit dodgy? It's very hard, isn't it? You're one person trying to filter.
Well, it's a very viable question, but I tell you what, if you had something traumatic, something eventful happen in your life, you don't trivialise it generally. And when you come to me or Amash, it's because if it's for the first time, you tend to be really nervous, you tend to be very self-conscious, you tend to be very, very brief, and you tend to say, you're going to think I'm crazy, and... You know, there's lots of different layers and areas of language and tonality that people use who are genuine. And this is just something that you pick up. And the others who go, I'm just in the garden. There's an alien taking me away. That's a hoax.
And that's always the risk, isn't it? Of course, the same kind of thing could be levelled at you. We'll get into a TV documentary that you were on recently that alerted me to your presence. We'll talk about that in a little while, but not right now. The fact of the matter is that there are lots of happy amateurs around these things. And, you know, I once knew a bunch of ghost hunters in one part of the UK. We won't say exactly where. But they were just having a great time. I don't know whether half of them took it at all seriously. It was just a bit of fun to a lot of them. I think there was a solid core of people who were really keen and committed to the research. But how can we be sure that you're not just a bunch of happy amateurs getting off on the fact that there might be something out there or there might not?
Yeah, well, again, that's an absolute valid question. And if I just rewind a little bit in who I am and where I've come from, maybe this will be a good jump point for people to get a feeling from, about Amash.
That's good. It means I don't have to ask the question. Can you just do one thing before you explain about yourself, which I was going to bring you on to, and then we'll get David Munro in. You said that it was mind management, that's one half of it, and the alien abductee side of it, the other half of it. Are those two things separate in your mind, or are they connected?
Absolutely connected. However, there are other elements of human interaction, which is just solid mind control, Monarch programming, MK Ultra, that kind of thing. But before we even go near there, because that's a whole nother strata, let me just give you a tiny little potted history of me.
Well, no, I'm keen to know about you, because one thing I am noticing about you, you're a very good communicator, if I may say so. You must have got that somewhere.
Well, I think, first of all, from a very young age, I have had a great interest in the human being. I mean, the human being and that process. And, we all have our difficulties. I'm no different to anybody else. And I've worked through a lot of my own difficulties and traumas. And because of that, and because also I recognize within me a spiritual core, and by that, I'm not talking about any religious or that is sprung from any religious creed or knowledge. It is to do with an inner knowing, not a belief, an inner knowing that there is something more bigger, which I am part, feeding in and representing in this vehicle that I'm in today. And so I went to explore that from a very young age.
You use the word vehicle. Vehicle for whom and for what?
Well, the vehicle that I'm in today is my body, which is a vehicle for my consciousness to explore what it is, that I'm doing here, and to try and deliver to my consciousness, if you like, as wide an array of experiences, but filtered through my learning and understanding. And what I mean by that is, for example, I have disability in my family, and I've been around in teaching meditation work, spiritual development work for a very, very long time, on and off. And that led me to work with a therapy system and learn that modality, which is basically a system of guided visualization that will very, very frequently go into a regression scenario. But basically, it looks at allowing people to have an ability to clear any imbalances, blockages, or points of, let's say, areas in the body-mind system that are not conducive to a positive life experience.
Joanne, can I ask you one quick thing before you continue? Are you banging a table, perhaps even without knowing it, as you make points? Because I'm getting an occasional knock when you make a point. You've got to be very careful.
I gesticulate even without anybody there. So I'll try and keep my hands down and not knocking any wires.
You can wave your hands around like a windmill, but just don't hit anything while you do it.
I think it's hitting the wire. I think that's what it was.
Let me ask you this then. What professional background do you have to do this? It's all very well being a new agey kind of person, which is the impression that I get of you.
I'm not a new agey. Can I just say, I am not a new agey person. Definitely do not give me that moniker, please.
Okay, well then, it was just some of the stuff you came out with then. And believe me, my listeners will email me with that if we don't nail that now. That'll come through.
Let me just filter through.
What is your real world job? What do you do?
Yeah, well, let me just back up a little bit and then I'll come forward to that point, because it's not very far. far away. So I initially went into training in theatre, performing arts and the rest of that. And then I did some retraining in television. So I've done quite a lot of production, Channel 4 and stuff when I used to live in London, all behind the scenes stuff, because I realised I wasn't that keen on being in front of the camera, believe it or not, in terms of being an actress.
I've seen your name on credits for TV programmes, haven't I? Haven't you been? Summer Scales is not a common name. I've seen that name.
Yeah, well, there is a Jew, Summer Scales, who writes for Emmerdale, but that is not me. Amazingly, okay. It's not me.
So, as I can tell from the way that you speak, which is very well, and the way that you communicate, which is also very clear, you're trained to do this.
Yes, I've had training in communication. I think communication is one of the most important things that we are doing. And if you don't communicate well, how on earth would you expect people to understand where you're coming from?
Well, you get no arguments about that from me at all. So what is it that brought you to an interest in alien abduction?
Right. All right. Let me come to that point, because it's absolutely wildly interesting. I think
I'm ready.
In my personal development, also, I will just say that my mother, who is amazing, said to me, "If you want to be an actress, I will be behind you all the way for your training, as long as you learn office skills." So, just on the professional thing, I've been, you know, working in office as a PA, doing, you know, various roles in that administrative level. So it allows me to be a reasonably good administrator as well. And I've also put on events, conferences, shows, that kind of thing. And I actually put on a big show in the West End in the Duke of York's Theatre in my much younger years for charity. And I'm laughing because I got the free services of Frankie Howard, George Sewell, Christopher Biggins, amongst others. And Frankie Howard actually cost me a gin and tonic. Bless him.
Well, no, that's excellent. Frankie Howard, for our listeners in the United States, was a veteran, venerable and incredibly funny comedian who had a couple of careers, really. He had a career around wartime in the 50s, and then he became a little passé, I think, for some people. And then he came Absolutely. And stormed back in the 1990s, and he found a whole new generation of people. But he used to, he had this unique voice, didn't he? He would say, chitter ye not. I can't look him up anyway. If you're in America,
it's
very funny
British,
guy.
Isn't it? Anyway,
in America, if you like Benny Hill, you would like Frankie Howard. It's spelled Howerd, not Howard, like my name. Okay, so you've got a theatrical background. You can communicate. We know that.
An administration, and I'm an organizer, and you know, I can bring things together and then push it out there and get it organized so it comes out.
Well, this is good, but what about the UFOs and aliens?
Yes, well, I'm just getting to that.
I'm
in
ready.
All my training work and therapy work and research, I met a lot of amazing people who are, you know, working on their own spiritual work and healing and stuff. And one of the people I met through a very good friend of mine is a Peruvian called Sixto Paz Wells. Some of your listeners may or may not have heard of him, but he's a Peruvian contactee, not an abductee, and he has he's in his 50s now. And when he was 17, he was doing some meditation with his mother and his sister, and through a process that is known as automatic writing, and I'll explain that if you want, he suddenly had a message come through his hand, pen went to paper, and out came this writing, this little dialogue, not a dialogue, a monologue, from a being called Oxalk, who described himself as being from one of the moons of Jupiter, in fact, Ganymede. And then there were others similar from Apu, another of the moons of Jupiter. And anyway, I had occasion to meet this gentleman several times, and I had done with a researcher called Andrew Johnson, who is a great exponent of Dr. Judy Wood's work, a little four-series piece called ETTV. So in about 2006, where I had a lot of just home footage of Sixto, me talking at the kitchen table to Sixto with my friend, Colombian friend, Cecilia, with her interpreting for me, translating. And so Sixto, when I met Sixto, I found him to be one of the most beautiful human beings in terms of his compassion and humanity. I was going to say human heart, humanity. But he also had an inner strength. Nobody's fool. And you know, so I really don't want to get this sort of new agey thingy going here, because it's not about that. It's about individuals being sovereign in their experience.
You see, it's the words, it's just the phrases that I've heard from a lot of these sort of people.
Okay.
Being sovereign in my experience. Of it is going to sound to some of my listeners like jargon. I don't want to dismiss what you're doing. That's the last thing I want to do, because, you know, this is what we're here to talk about. But it's those kind of buzz phrases that are interesting.
Well, I don't mind the buzz phrase sovereign being, because sovereign simply means, you know, a lot of just in our lives, I am sure you and David and certainly myself have been in conditions and situations where we have felt disempowered. We have felt things done to. Maybe we felt that things, maybe we've been a victim at the, you know, for one moment of our lives, or seen somebody else be that. And when I'm talking about sovereignty, I'm talking about, okay, that's an experience. And then you go and you say, right, okay, how can I turn this around, and how can I be a responsible for myself as a being, but also interact with my fellow beings in a way that is more positive, where I am not going to get damaged, where I am not, where there is a positive thing. So
that sounds good. So how does this Peruvian man, with his automatic writing, which is where your hand writes stuff that you are not controlling, something else is controlling
it. That's right.
Sometimes people can do that with two hands, left and right. I've actually seen that happen.
It's amazing.
So had he been abducted? What was his story?
He was a contactee. He's a contactee. The only book in English, well, I think it's the only book in English, there was at the time I knew him better, was The Invitation. And it's all this early story. And basically, what this being said to him was that he lived about 60 miles or kilometres south of the Chilka Desert. He said, we will meet you, come along, and at this time, at this place, we'll meet you. And so he turned up. He's a lad of 17 with one or two friends, and these ships did appear. And they legged it. They were absolutely terrified.
As you might, because they kept the appointment.
I think it's very funny. And, you know, he tells this story against himself. And when he finally got himself settled and calmed again and in a state where he could communicate, Oxalt came through again and said, hey, you know, we can't communicate with you when you're in a state of hysteria or emotional upset. Come on, get a grip, kind of thing. And they basically gave him some instruction on doing a bit of yoga, dealing with his nutrition, because our brain and body chemistry is very important in how we communicate, with ourselves and others, but certainly these other dimensionalities.
And so, what is it that made you believe this man?
Because he is so grounded in his knowing. He's articulate. His thinking isn't skewed. He's not off into some fantasy world. He is very plugged in. He's got a wife and two kids who also have been with him when they've had experiences. And you meet these people for a certain length of time, and if they are lying or they're delusional, there's going to be cracks and you know, things falling out of their story. It didn't happen. And I've met him now many times, and he is just, he's like a little beacon of light. He's wonderful. And
is he still connected? Is he still in contact?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I haven't actually spoken to Sixto probably for about 5 or 6 years.
But you last talked to him, he was still in contact.
Absolutely.
What were the beings who were in contact with him telling him about? Were they giving him any useful information for us here?
Well, what they were speaking to him about was the fact that our planet is in trouble, that if we don't kind of wake up and smell the coffee, it is going to get damaged beyond measure. And we have to realize that we are really important, really spiritually orientated beings with a lot of potential to realize our true pathway, whatever that is for each and every individual.
If only we'll wake up to it. Where are these people? Where are these beings from? Have they told him that?
Do you know what? Oxalk was telling him that they were from one of the moons of Jupiter. He mentioned the two moons, Apu and Ganymede.
Mm-hmm, as you say.
You know, it's ages ago that I read his stuff. So it was just that he was my kind of foundation. And I began looking around and doing quite a bit of research in the UK. And there was nothing. There was really nothing where anybody could feed through. And when I met one or two people and also heard reports by others of people that they'd known who were abductees, because I didn't know much about abductees in those earlier days. I was hearing about trauma. I was hearing about fear. I was hearing about health conditions. And one of my big things is to help with this trauma and help people be well, because if we are well, if our chemistry is right, then we can function and we can be really quite magnificent in our being. And I'm not saying you have to go and become a Bill Gates or anything like that, but in our beingness of who we are.
So somebody comes to you and they ask for help, and because you've got this background in therapy, you can help them to deal with what I can imagine would be. I mean, I wouldn't mind meeting aliens. I'd rather like to. But for a lot of people, it is a tremendous trauma. I don't know how I'd react, but I'd like to give it a try. So you're really helping them through it.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things, part of my role in the past, I also took a teaching certificate because I was already teaching various healing modalities, and I just wanted to see if my teaching was anywhere near what the national curriculum was expecting of a tutor. And my teaching qualification allows me to teach in any adult ed institute, so it's not kiddywinks or anything, but it is really a process. You know, all of us are going through processes, and sometimes I used to do bereavement counselling as a volunteer for the hospice down in the southeast. I did that for about 3 years, and you know, mostly what I find is people need to be heard. Most people are so busy going around their lives, we don't hear one another.
That's true. I totally, completely agree with you about that. So
we don't allow each other, you know, to even speak about our daily, you know, normal kind of things. So when there is something so off the wall for somebody, and you know, just let me give you a little example, and then I really would like to bring David in.
And so would I, but I'd love to hear the example.
I'm working with a gentleman at the moment called Mike Smith. He's got some videos out there, because one of the things Amash does, just before I go into his story, is not only do I tend to be the first port of call, but speak to people to let them know that they're heard, to let them know that they're valued. Now, that doesn't mean I believe everything they say first off. No, it doesn't. But what it means is I'm willing to listen. You're a human being, and I have compassion for that. And let's talk more, and let's see where that goes. If I feel that this could be explored and would be really helpful for others to hear, because some people say, you know, thank God I've been able to speak to someone, to get this burden off my back, to share it, because I thought I was going crazy. I mean, one of the things, I had the text on my phone after the program was, you know, after watching that program, thank you, because I thought I was alone. Hmm. And that's, you know, the isolation that people feel is absolutely extraordinary. Now, Mike Smith, just getting back to him to pick up that thread, is a guy who is ex-Special Forces, ex-Army. He's also a musician. He spent most of his life as a musician. However, from a very young child, he was having experiences being the collective word for anomalous events. Anomalous events could be anything, except in this case, coming through the door of Amash, it tends to mean something to do with other dimensional entities, other paranormal stuff, all of that. Now, this guy is in his early 60s at the moment, and it wasn't until he was 43 that he even knew he had any experiences at all. And when he had whatever triggered him into this, let me call it a download, it was like a floodgate had opened. And he said, within milliseconds, I knew everything that people had said to me, that people had tried to tell me and I wouldn't have it, was true. I mean, and this is a guy who had, after he came out of the army in his mid-20s, he had a severely physically disabled brother who, as a kid, would see him being taken, and he would try and tell him. Now, Mike is the sort of guy, is black is black and white is white, and that's the way it is then. And he thought that if there was ever any mention of UFOs or ETs, that you must be losing your mind. He thought you must have had too much to drink, or you were, in his words, a nutter. And he'd leave the room. That's how closed he was to this anomaly or anomalous stuff. So you can imagine, here is this guy with 20 years under his belt of knowing what's gone on, to some degree, we're still discovering, we're writing a book. about his experience. It's the most extraordinary case. And part of this is very healing, but also quite traumatic, because a lot of the writing and the delving in is bringing back even more memories, which can be very, very challenging.
And just tell me, before we get to the world's most patient man, Dave, who's waiting in Scotland, Dave, thanks very much for being so patient. Tell me one of the stories that, this Mike Smith has told you. He sounds like a very grounded man. It makes me wonder why he would need to come to you when he seems to be handling this pretty well.
He didn't. No, nobody needs to come to me at all. It's not that. It's just that, where do we go with this stuff, Howard? Who hears us? And I'm not being rhetorical here. I mean, you know, people have lost friends, families, jobs, their livelihoods. They've lost homes. They've moved a million times to try and escape the events. It never works. Who do you tell?
It must be a terribly, terribly lonely position to be in. Even if you're the strongest, if you're a tower of strength and the most strongest person in the world, I would imagine it's incredibly difficult to go through on your own. Why I understand the reason you're doing this and how it can help. Tell me what sorts of things have happened to this man, though, because you're writing a book with him. He must have had some amazing experiences.
Well, let me tell you one of the most poignant experiences, which is astonishing. Mike was born in 1950 and from a very poor background in the Midlands, West Midlands. He's a West Midlands guy. And part of his growing up, he had this very badly disabled brother. So his mother would spend a lot of time at hospital with him. He had a younger sister that there was no one to look after, so that fell to him. She went to school and he'd be the little house dad, actually, because his dad was actually going to work many miles away. So there was no one else at home to do the domestic stuff. So that fell to young Mike for many years. So this gentleman hardly had any education at all. He says so himself. And so what he would do for his pleasure was to go out into the fields, out into the crops, make himself a little, kind of hole in the crops, and we would lie on the ground, look up, be in nature. And this one, and so with his background, they had very little money. As I said, they were from a very poor background. So vehicles and things like that were not common in those days. And in his locale either. And there's a reason I'm saying that. And as he's lying down there on this particular occasion, so we're 1959 or 60, 61, somewhere around there, he sees a couple of balloons go ahead over him. I mean, and these are big. And he thinks, well, that's unusual because there's no wind. So he was a savvy little guy. So anyway, he stands up to see what's going on. And all of a sudden he said, you can't believe it, Joanne, I'm standing in a massive, what we call now, crop circle. He hadn't seen it being made. He was just stood up.
So this thing in 1959 appeared around him.
Yes.
Wow.
But that's not the thing of it. That's not the UL bit. That's pretty UL anyway. But the next thing he sees is a vehicle in the field as if it's parked. Well, he didn't see any vehicle arrive, but he was so excited because there was a vehicle and all he could think was he'd seen a picture of Donald Campbell's Bluebird. Now, you may want to explain who and what
I will, but I think he was also known in America, Donald Campbell, and I do remember Donald Campbell. In fact, Donald Campbell's father and then the son, the Donald Campbell that I remember, they were both speed merchants. They were people who liked to break speed records, and Donald Campbell died trying to break the speed record over water at Coniston Lake in the Lake District in the UK in 1967. So that's Donald Campbell.
Right. So what this young boy thought at that time was, wow, I wonder if that's Donald Campbell's Bluebird, which was the name of this vehicle. So as he's wondering this, he sees four people coming toward him and he says they're people. So that is, they are looking like humans. Otherwise, he said, I would have noticed. So these four people are coming toward him. They're blonde, very Nordic looking, obviously a mum and dad and two kids, but they're taller than him. The children, that is. And they come toward him and he's all agog with this craft, this vehicle. I mean, he just thinks it's a car somehow.
Because it's 1959 and you're quite young. What else? How can your brain handle that? It's the only way you could rationalize it is to say, well, it's some kind of speedy car.
Yeah, but and this is what happens. That is a very, very salient point, Howard, because as he says, and as many people say to me when they're telling me their stories, at first it's so mind-boggling, they project the rationale of what could that possibly be in this life. I mean, they don't give it that dimension, but, you know, they say it must be X or must be Y because they have no frame of reference for anything else. So here these people are coming toward him, and they meet, and there's nothing scary. There's nothing, or he just thinks it's very ordinary. And he said to them, wow, is that Donald Bluebird, Donald Campbell's Bluebird? And they say, no. And he said, well, where are you from? And they just point skyward. And he suddenly he said, are you God? Isn't that cute? I mean, are you God? I mean, how wonderful. It's a child. And they say, no, that's a human concept.
Oh, boy.
Very interesting. So anyway, they engage him in some conversation. He doesn't remember all of it, but part of it he does remember is that they said to him that the earth was, I can't remember how he phrased it, but it was something like, is in trouble, or is having difficulties, or is in difficulties. Would he help? And he said, yeah, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, you'll know when the time comes. And I've said to David, okay, you're 60, to Mike, you're 63, what's going on?
It better hurry up and come.
I don't know. Anyway, so what happened next is that they invited him on board ship. They said, do you want to come for a ride? He went, yeah.
Remind me again, how old was he then?
He thinks he was 11, but we're not sure if he was 9 or 11. He was between those ages, but maybe it's 11.
So this is every little kid's dream, isn't it? And in 1959, there was lots of talk about spaceships, and you know, we hadn't quite had Yuri Gagarin in space, but it was very much the talk of the age, wasn't it, from what I read?
Yeah, so it's either 59, 60, 61, one of those 3 years. Anyway, so he goes on this device, this craft, and he's not frightened. They're not scary to him at all. They're just pleasant. And he said, and they must have spoken to me normally, i.e. him seeing the mouth move, he said, because I would have noticed otherwise. And they leave him. When they go in the craft, he says he sees the earth receding at a rate of knots. That's my saying, a rate of knots, but, you know, moving away fast. And he just thinks it's an adventure. And then he's there with the two kids, and the kids are moving a small ball, like a very small beach ball, with their mind. And so he's observing this and thinking, you know, that's good. And they say to him, well, you do it. You can do it. And he says, no, I can't. They said, yes, you can. You do it. Honestly, just do it. And so he did it. But then he says to me, he reports back and he says, but I don't think I did, you know, because I can't do it now in this dimension. And then the parents came for him and said, come on, we want to show you part of the ship. And they showed him, do you know what I mean by the old-fashioned spinning top, Howard, where you had a central pivot point and it was actually like a spaceship shape. And then when you pushed down on that central pivot point, which had a little ball on the top, the thing spun like crazy.
And some of these things, I've seen pictures of these things that they had a spiral of colour around them, didn't they? And that would become continuous as this thing spun.
Ah, right. Well, in the toy. Yes, indeed. Anyway, but that's what they showed, or something like that is what they showed him. And except it seemed to be more opaque, more of perhaps a colourless thing. And he said, as that speeded up, as they showed him it speeding up, so he knew the ship was speeding up. Which was, a fantastic adventure to him.
I've got to get him on this show. You must talk to him.
They brought him back. Mm. They brought him back.
To the field where he'd been before.
To the field. Now he'd arrived in the field on his bike, and suddenly he got back and there's no bike. And the next thing is because he's wondering how on earth he's going to get home. And they bring his bike back. So I don't know what that deal is, whether they were looking at it or whether they just found it and they wanted him to get home safe, so they gave him the bike.
Lose time?
He wouldn't be aware. He wasn't aware of anything, because this was all real time. As we know it, you know, that as far as he's aware, that he was in the field, saw the balloon, saw the craft, saw the people, got on the ship, got off the ship. You know, that was a period of time. It wasn't a missing time, as far as I'm aware.
And are you convinced? Because things happen to children, don't they?
Yes,
lots
I
of
am.
Things happen to children, and children fantasize.
Yeah.
And some children, they delude themselves, they convince themselves that the thing that they fantasized actually happened. Are you sure that isn't his story?
I am. You know, I was a child once too. And I remember, you know, my daydreams and things like that. And I know about being a kid like everybody else does. And no, I wasn't deluded about anything. And I don't think he was. He's an extremely bright guy.
And these experiences continued for him?
Not well, that was a one-off, but he's had many more. But you know what?
When you say he's had many more, you mean abduction experiences?
Oh, goodness me, yeah. I mean, you know what? This is like five shows, this story.
All right, well, I'd like to talk to you and him at some point. But let's get to the world's most patient man at Lossiemouth in Scotland. Dave Munro, I'm really sorry for keeping you waiting. What's your connection with all of this?
First of all, don't worry about the apology because I'm thoroughly engrossed in the conversation. And
it is truly fascinating, Joanne. Well explained.
It is very
well
fascinating.
Done.
And Mike Smith, I've never met Mike Smith, but Mike and I share a number of things in common here, trust me, listening to the narrative that Joanne presented.
Are you a serial abductee? Do you think you are?
Well, it's the use of this... word abductee is one that I sometimes question, and a number of people who have had experiences also question the use of the word abductee. But you know, we really need a more suitable term for this experience.
And I agree.
Experience is one of the
okay. Well,
John
well,
and I have discussed
describe
it.
Then if I'll try not to use that phrase serial abductee, but tell me about one of your experiences then. Tell me about the one that would convince me that what you believe has happened has happened.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you about my most graphic experience. But before I do that, there's a couple of things I'd like to point out. One is you said yourself that there would be, if presented with the opportunity to enter an extraterrestrial craft, that you would welcome it, and but many people would feel, you know, tremendous trauma over the thought. Well, my response to that would be, of course they would, because that's the program. They are programmed to fear the unknown.
By whom?
There is a program going on, I have no doubt in my own mind, that we are taught to fear these things. And Joanne used the term frame of reference, which is very apt also in the context she used it in.
So who would be programming us to fear this, and why would they be wanting to do that?
Well, I firmly believe, along with millions, if not more than millions of people now, that you know, there are people who run the globe as an almost like a PLC. And, you know, things are going their way at the moment. And
so, PLC, for our listeners in North America, PLC is Public Limited Company. It's a corporation, basically.
It's a corporation, yeah, basically. But with respect, I don't particularly want to go down that road because that would be a 12 program series.
All right, before you tell me about an abduction experience, what's your background, though? You know, what have you done in your life?
What have I done in my life? I grew up in poverty. I grew up in the north of Scotland. My mother was alcoholic, so we had a kind of, as the Americans would say, a dysfunctional background. I joined the Royal Navy at the age of 16. I had no formal qualifications whatsoever. I was a very nervous, pretty dysfunctional child in a lot of respects. Very scared. I was full of fear. And so I went to the British Armed Forces because it was an easy option for us in those days. This was in 1966. I'm also 63 now.
And we have to say that an awful lot of people, it was the making of them. My father was in the army and then later in the police. And from his background, which you know was not a rich background by any manner of means, it was the making of him.
Well, I have a lot to be thankful for to the UK Armed Forces. I had a very, very diverse experience with the UK Armed Forces. I joined the flying side of the Royal Navy, the Fleet Air Arm, in a non-flying task. And I spent most of my time aboard aircraft carriers travelling around the Far East and the Mediterranean and stuff, or in naval air stations.
When was this, Dave? What era?
1966.
Okay.
Until, and then I got involved. I was selected to do, we'll use the term military training. It was military training, and I undertook quite a number of military training courses, and I subsequently then went into a program which was run by the Army, which was a more specialized program. Most of my instructors were from UK Special Forces, if not all of them. Yeah, pretty much all of them were from UK Special Forces. And I undertook tasks and responsibilities in that particular job. I then spent...
Well, does that mean you were connected with the equivalent of the Special Air Services, the SAS?
I was tasked and trained by... involved in some of their operations. I have to be very careful here. I signed a piece of paper, which...
Yeah, which, I know that some of this stuff you're not allowed to talk about, so we won't go too far down that road.
I could talk about it, but I don't want to go to prison. No, but look, you know, bread and water's not good.
And I would hate you to have to go to prison, and I don't want to go there myself. However, all we can say is that you have a military background, and the military background you have is at a high level and responsible. You're a level-headed guy.
It was a reasonably... I was in middle management level. That's a sort of term that seems to be current.
But they don't give responsibility to people who are not able to handle it. So, you know, you had certain responsibility by the sounds of it.
Yes, I did have responsibility. And I left... I worked in Free Commando Brigade for some years, nearly 6 years there. And I subsequently left the forces. I went to Africa in safety and security. I worked in Africa for a couple of years. I was head of security on a luxury American cruise liner, and I was head of security on the Oriana. And then I became head of operations for the UN mission in Kosovo, Department of Justice, where I was chief operations officer for them. And at my last task, I worked for the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in The Hague, Holland.
So what a fantastic... I had no idea, Dave, what a fantastic background you have. So what brought you into contact with aliens and abduction? I mean, the background that you've just outlined is the most level-headed background I can imagine.
Well, you know, it's not... You said what brought me into contact with them. They brought me into contact.
tell me how that happened.
Well... Joanne alluded to the fact that, you know, sometimes we only get information relating to our past, those of us experiencers, when we're in our later years, and this most certainly has happened to me. But my most graphic experience was my wife and I, about 4 years ago, it was Christmas Day, we live in Lossiemouth in the north of Scotland, we'd seen many UFO We'd had many UFO experiences, although most of them at a fair distance, I have to say. But UFOs nonetheless. And this particular Christmas Day, we had an elderly couple who were neighbours who were in their 80s, and we'd invited them round for Christmas dinner. And about 8 o'clock at night, they went home, and it was a dreadful night, terrible night, typical north of Scotland, you know, blowing a storm, snow, high winds, etc. And my wife, who is Serbian, Alma, she decided that, you know, we'd go to this beach, which was about 14 miles to the west, for a walk, because we go to the beach in all sorts of weather here, simply because we have to. We seldom get the sun. But on this occasion, we went to the east, and we went approximately 18, 20 miles to the east. Now, I'd never gone that way before at night to a beach, and I don't know to this day what made me go there, but I went there nonetheless. And we stood on a very small beach in a snowstorm, and there was a main road behind us. There was a caravan park the other side of the main road, and there was traffic moving up and down. Nobody on foot, because it was really quite a dreadful night. And my wife saw a typical, what we call a typical orange ball, which was a UFO away to the west, I beg your pardon. And it disappeared, but then she shouted, "It's come back." And to cut the story short, it came right along the coast. It described the contour of the coast, which was a kind of a curved coastline. And it came right down to us. Now, the next thing was...
But when you say, if I can just stop you for half a second, it came right down to you, how close did you perceive it to be?
Well, if I can just go back to... As it approached me, it changed its shape, first of all. There was a sound like a million bees buzzing. Okay, there was a... If you can imagine the old... We used to have fans in Singapore to keep the messes cool. And we used to put cardboard into the fans, you know, and they would make that sort of noise.
Well, it's a sort of rasping noise, isn't it?
Yeah. Right. Well, if you can multiply that by 5 billion decibels, this was really loud, and it changed into a plasma ball. It was a huge pulsating plasma ball. It was pink mauve in color, with an incandescent white light in the center of it, and a rotating plasma field around it. Now, at that stage, the entire area was covered in colors that are outside of the available spectrum that, you know, available to me that I could, you know, accurately describe. But blues, mauves, and whites were predominant. And I heard screaming, and I looked around, and my wife was running. She was frantically trying to get into the car and screaming at the same time. And she couldn't get in the car because I had the keys in my pocket. And with that, she took off down the road. And I looked, this thing was approximately 20 feet above me and just to my right. And it was stationary.
And 20 feet above you, I would be terrified.
Well, I wasn't, but I was a week later on the second event. But this one, I just looked up and I honestly and truthfully said, please don't do anything to us because we love you.
Really? Now, what made you say that?
Well, I'd read, by that time, I'd had sufficient knowledge of UFOs. And I'd read vociferously a whole raft of stuff, anything and everything I could get my hands on to educate myself, because I knew these things were real. I'd had, and then...
How did you know they were real?
I know they're real.
When you said that, you said that with such assurance. I just wondered if you had a reason for, at that stage, knowing.
Well, what we're dealing with here, with respect, is consciousness. And once you have a UFO experience of some proximity, then your consciousness changes. And with that, your frame of reference changes. Now, most people have not had those experiences there, by ergo, by definition, they have no frame of reference. None whatsoever. Just the same as I didn't. I could go back now, a week later, oh, by the way, that particular night, there was a total suspension of normality. The waves which had been crashing on the beach, this thing left and it went away to the west very slowly. I now had to go and get my wife back to the car, which was, and you can imagine what it was like in the car. But there had been a total suspension of normality. There was no sound whatsoever other than the sound from the UFO. There had been cars travelling up and down that road. There were none whilst this experience was ongoing.
So nobody else would have seen this?
Well, they did, as it turns out, but we only discovered that some years later.
Really?
But what happened here is we were en route back and we decided we were shaking because shock had set in. Alma was terribly shocked. And on this quiet coastal road driving home, Alma shouted, "They are back."
Oh, Lord.
And we stopped the car. Mm-hmm. And there were eight of them going across the sea, and they were changing shape, changing color. They were alternating from golden cigar shapes into, there were three together and then five staggered over a period of some miles, an area of some miles behind.
And was Alma's experience of this exactly the same as yours? When you talked about it, which I'm sure you must just after this.
Yeah.
Identical.
Yeah. And the next saga here is we went to a local town to make a report to the police, but the police had already been called out because Switchboard, I later found out, was jammed with...
Really?
With people who had... Yeah. So the next stage was another one turned up over a housing estate and was doing an aerobatic display. So we managed to get some people out from the houses to witness this, and photographs were taken and stuff. Subsequently, the police interviewed me. I was with the police for some considerable time, at the end of which I said to the policeman, you know, what do you think? And he said, well, and I can remember his words quite clearly. He said, there was a time when I would have laughed at all of this, but not any longer. He said, I can't go into detail. We've had a spate of related incidents throughout the day. A week later, I had another experience with Alma in the car when about 8 miles from our home. It was 7 minutes after midnight on New Year's Eve, and an orange ball again turned up, sat in a field some 200 meters from the car, and just turned into if you can imagine a huge sun, a huge golden, glimmering, shimmering sun. And then shortly after that, another one came along. Now, there was another car witnessed this with five occupants, but they were so scared that they drove away. We didn't. We stayed for a wee while. But then I did become extremely scared for some reason, and we drove home. But those are the two main events. But certainly we've had many, many other events, and other situations have subsequently been the case.
Dave, thank you very, very much for sharing that amazing story. I mean, it does sound utterly amazing to me. Did they try to communicate with you? They seemed, since this, the best of this display seemed to have been put on for and very close to you. Did they try and communicate in any way? You told them you loved them and they didn't hurt you.
That's correct. And they are responsive, I believe, very strongly to our emotions. On the second occasion, as soon as I felt fear, the thing stopped. Did they try to communicate with me? I had an implant in my left nasal cavity, which was some years before these events.
How do you know that?
I picked it out.
And what was it? Because the descriptions I've heard from people like Roger Lear, the doctor who operates on these things in America, these can be little tiny pieces of metal.
Yes, that's correct. I didn't mean to interrupt you. What I was going to do was tell you what it was before you told me. And so that you could say, well, yeah, that's exactly what Roger Lear has said. Yes, it was a very, very small metallic ball. It was under the skin in the nasal cavity. I still have the actual cavity is still there. It's never grown over.
What about the implant?
That went. I didn't know what it was at the time.
And you say, when did you throw it away?
I just dumped. I picked it out of my nose. It's not a pleasant experience, but
it doesn't sound it.
A tissue and put it in some bin or other. But yeah.
And do you think that this thing, Dave, was tracking you, and that's how they knew where you were?
I very definitely do. And I think there's a very interesting book, which I don't get my information from books, by the way. I get my information from my experiences. But it's inevitable that I read books and find parallels, similarities, and evidence of that what I've experienced is real. And I went to live in Holland when I worked for the chemical weapons people. And during that time, I went into a secondhand bookshop in The Hague, and the first book I saw was a book by a quite famous experiencer called George Hunt Williamson, called Other Tongues, Other Flesh. And one whole chapter of that book, which I have in an extensive collection of books upstairs, relates to people that they track, people that they have seeded, for want of a better description, and people that they keep an eye on.
So for some reason that you don't know, you're a chosen one. You're a selected one.
Exclusive. I think that we're all chosen ones.
And what about your wife? What about Alma?
In respect of?
Well, in respect of, did she have an implant? Was she going through what you've been through?
No. Alma, she's seen the same stuff that I've seen. But she's not had the same experiences. Quite regularly, I have marks on my body in the same places, which are effectively long finger marks. They're always in the same place.
So you believe you're being taken away, but you haven't recalled it. Have you tried regression?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Well, I've done an awful lot of psychic studies and psychic practices, and born out of my events, my experiences.
And your interest in these things, did that precede the events happening to you, or did the events happening to you happen before your interest was fired?
No, that's a key question, and it's also a very good question and relevant question. I'd always been interested in other things, otherworldly things. When I was in Kosovo, I used to meet up with some Russian guys and some American guys, all of whom were involved in various levels in the UN administration of Kosovo. And the common thread in all of these discussions was matters extraterrestrial. And some of the stuff that the Russian guys related was really quite phenomenal and has been corroborated by people like David Wilcock in the United States of America, where he described nuclear weapons being taken offline after UFO visits to nuclear storage facilities.
And there have been over the years suggestions, Dave, that the Russians were, maybe are, connected at a very high level.
Connected?
Well, connected to whatever, if you believe that there are extraterrestrials, connected to them.
Well, I think that there are several nations that are connected to, as far as the ETs are concerned, I think, and I have no direct experience of this, we really are all one nation. I don't think that they're flag wavers. I think that, you know, politics and flags and nationalities and stuff are very much of this earth. They're artificial constructs to a degree, which are all designed to keep us in place.
So have you kept in touch with those Americans and Russians that you met in Kosovo?
I have kept in touch with some of them, yes, yes.
And some of those people, apart from telling you hair-raising stories, are they experiencers themselves?
Well, they've had experience of UFOs, yes, yes. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, you sound incredibly level-headed, and if I may say so, you relayed this story perfectly. I can see the pictures of what you described in my mind's eye. What do you want to do now, and why have you connected with Amash and Joanne?
Well, I have this. I spent a long time in my life being scared, and so I created a different me to overcome that. You know, I became kind of aggressive, and I became very military-minded, and I became super efficient and all of that rubbish. I developed an alcohol problem. I haven't drunk alcohol in any way, shape, or form for 18 years. I had a very bad accident 18 years ago. I died on an operating table, and I am still here.
And forgive me for this question, because my listeners will ask me why I didn't ask it, so, and I'm sure you've heard it before. Yeah. You were not under the influence, were you, when you saw the things that you saw?
No, no. I stopped taking alcohol on the 26th of July in 1996. I've never touched it since.
And let's just say again, when these experiences, the two that were one week apart, when was that?
Well, they're ongoing, but the main one was about 4 years ago. But I was with a group of people. I've got a large group of people who used to scoff and laugh. And I live in a small community, and, you know, I'm quite well known in the community. And they used to have a wee laugh. Here's Dave, you know, have you been abducted today, Dave? That kind of stuff. But I organized them to come on a beach watch one night, and lo and behold, they came down. And so the laughing and the scoffing has stopped, and they formed groups, and they tell other people. And so we have regular groups of people up here in the north of Scotland who are going out looking for UFOs, and it's all quite interesting.
Well, let me tell you something. I know the south of Scotland quite well. I've done some radio work and training there. I long to come to the north of Scotland. I would personally, if I could connect with anything, I would love to experience the north of Scotland, so maybe one day we can make that happen and I can be part of this.
Well, I had a guy, a funny story for you. I had a guy, you're always welcome here. You know, Joanne has all of my contact details. I had a guy out on a bike one night, which was just before Christmas last. I beg your pardon, just after Christmas. And he was a bit of a skeptic. And I said, let's get the bikes out. And I've got really good lights and everything else. And so we dressed appropriately with the old high-vis vests and helmets and everything. Off we went. And we'd cycled about 2 miles down this forested road when one came flying straight across the trees. And the guy that was with me cycled into a ditch at the side of the road. As he was trying to get his camera out of his pocket to take a photo.
Poor man. Oh, dear. So this is regular. This is happening all the time. And you are so calm when you describe it, Dave.
Well, you know, I'm not afraid anymore in any way, shape or form. And I mean in general terms in my life, because I, you know, anything, and you asked, you know, why I got involved. I think that what I, Joanne and I, believe it or not, don't really know one another that well, but she resonates very strongly with me. I feel that she's an extremely good person. She's trying her best on limited resources to help people less fortunate than me. All of my experiences to date have been, at best, you know, benevolent, benign. Some people have had other experiences.
And let's face it, you sound like a guy who's got the fortitude to handle it, and I'm sure there are people who don't.
Well, that's a possibility, you know, but there are people around who have had horrendous experiences. And my own view on those horrendous experiences is that they're not being driven from other realms. They're being driven from here. That's my own view on that.
So somebody, and this has been said before, that somebody has control of whatever this phenomenon is here.
Yeah, I believe that there is an element of truth in that. I believe that possibly deals were struck, you know, and that stuff changed hands. We live in a world down here which is all about money. You can, you know, it's money that gives power, and then the power brings more money.
I think that's, the more I live in this world, and I've been a journalist for years, the more I believe it. The older I get, the more of that I believe, Dave. Very, very quickly, and Joanne, before I come back to you to conclude this, I think you've both been amazing, and thank you very much for sharing your stories and your experiences with me. But when you say that other people have had terrible experiences, Dave, the ones that you've heard about from them, are they sort of experimentation by beings?
I spoke to a lady. I go to a number of events here and there in the UK which are UFO related, and I spoke to one lady who she explained to me that she'd been taken successively for a number of years, and she really wasn't happy about it. When I tried to speak to her about the sort of pain or the negative element of it, she couldn't precisely put her finger on it. She was just unhappy with the experience. And you know, my own view on all of this is that we've all been lied to as human beings. We've been given a false history. We've been told rubbish about who we truly are, and most importantly, and Joanne spoke about sovereignty, which is most important, we're not aware of the power that we have, the power for good. Now, the sponsors of that power for good, our creators or our sponsors, I believe, are showing us in a way that they can make sense of, and that they have their frames of reference.
And they are hoping that we pick up on the message. Dave, I'm going to have to park it there with you, and I'm really sorry. Stay on the line, though. I just want to come quickly back to Joanne, because we've easily filled more than an hour here, Joanne, and I think we could. Unfortunately, we can't do 2 hours. Physically, we don't have that capability. But
we'll just have to have a regular once-a-month catch-up.
We're going to have to do this again. I think we're definitely going to have to do this again. And Dave, you said, was somebody that we really ought to meet, and you're dead right about that. Very quickly, and you know, I don't want you to go into detail particularly about the production and what you think about the people who produce this thing, but there was a TV documentary, 2 months ago now, about some of your people and yourself. I felt that it was perhaps a little more sceptical than it needed
it
to be.
It was shocking. As somebody said to me, I thought I was making a different program.
It was not your best day, was it?
The powers that be do not want this out there as being credible. Okay. So they will do everything they can.
So what you want to do now is use the alternative media.
But I will go back, you know, if things are correct and right, to mainstream, but on my own terms, there will be no negotiation in certain departments ever again.
Well, let me tell you
that they've set the bar.
My background is hard news. I've done a lot of the big hard news stories, including 9/11 and Diana's death and lots of other things like that. Yeah. Real tough, hard news. Hmm. I am a skeptic.
This is tough, hard news.
Well, I am a skeptic, but I'm not a cynic. I'm not cynical about it.
Nothing wrong with being open-minded.
No, I will ask hard questions. Because that's the only way we're going to learn anything. I wish you well with your work, Joanne. We must stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for introducing me to Dave in Lossiemouth in Scotland. Dave, thank you very much as well.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye, Howard.
Well, I promised you we'd do the alien experience from the British side, and there we just have. If you want to get a link to the people behind the material we've just been talking about, you can do that at my website, www.theunexplained.tv, which is also the place to make a donation to the show to ensure that it keeps running, or to send me a guest suggestion, or just make some comment about the show, whatever you'd like to do. You can do that through the website, www.theunexplained.tv. Radio.tv. Wherever in this world of ours you are, I hope you stay cool, calm and collected through this summertime. And I've got some good guests coming soon. I'm in contact with Paul Hellyer, the former Defence Minister of Canada, who has some very firm views about UFOs. Richard Hoagland, going to be talking about Mars by the looks of it. David Icke, definitely now in the middle of August. He's been very, very busy lately. And that's just a selection of some of the guests. There's also a man from Australia who's been touring the UK. My sister heard him speak recently, and he talks about a concept called mindfulness. We hope to be getting him on too. If you want to make a suggestion for a guest, you know how to do it. Go to the website. I would love to hear from you. Please take care. My name is Howard Hughes. You've been listening to The Unexplained, and I will return soon.